Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. President Barack Obama says the United States and Ethiopia are strong partners on many issues, but is urging the government to allow journalists and opposition parties to operate more freely. In a news conference Monday with Ethiopian Prime Minister Hailemariam Desalegn, Mr. Obama praised Ethiopia's economic record and had this to say.
But in the past 15 years, Ethiopia has lifted millions of people out of poverty. We're working closely together to improve food security, to help farmers plant drought-resistant and higher-yield crops. We're building resilience to climate change. Fewer people are suffering needlessly from preventable diseases like malaria. More children are getting an education.
The U.S. president said he also held frank discussions with the prime minister and said opening space for journalists and opposition voices will strengthen rather than inhibit the ruling party's agenda. The U.S. State Department says widespread human trafficking is helping fuel the vast fortunes on the world economy, leaving millions of people exploited by unscrupulous labor overseers and sex traders in virtually every country of the world. In its annual human rights report, the State Department called the exploitation modern slavery, brutalizing girls and women into prostitution and forcing men, women, and children into low-wage jobs across the globe, if they are even paid at all for their work. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says human trafficking and modern slavery is an industry worth $150 billion a year. He said this year's report needs to be a call to action and urged governments to strengthen and enforce their laws. You are listening to the news coming to you from Washington, D.C. The U.S. is backing Turkey's two-pronged air offensive and artillery strikes against Islamic State militants in Syria and Kurdish rebel targets in Iraq. A White House spokesman said Sunday Ankara was within its rights to take action related to terrorist targets, including when it struck a Kurdish Workers' Party town overnight Friday in northern Iraq, marking the first offensive against the outlawed Kurdish groups there since a peace accord was announced in 2013. Spokesman's comments follow a week in which violence in Turkey was blamed on both organizations, who are themselves staunch rivals. Turkey has called for a special meeting Tuesday with its fellow NATO member states to discuss Turkey's security concerns. Terror attack in India's Punjab state has left at least 10 people dead and prompted authorities to increase security along the border with Pakistan. Officials say 3 to 4 heavily armed men dressed in army fatigues first fired on a bus from a stolen car, then headed to a police complex in the town of Dhanagar. Opening fire as they stormed the building, commandos and police reinforcements rushed to the scene, engaging in a nearly 12-hour gun battle that killed the attackers. Officials say security forces are now searching the building. Separately, investigators say 5 bombs were found on railroad tracks between Dhanagar and Pathankot, a town with a heavy army presence, suggesting more attacks had been planned. The death toll is up to 18 following Sunday's bombing of the Jazeera Palace Hotel in Mogadishu by militant group Al-Shabaab. 5 more deaths were reported Monday, including that of a Chinese embassy staff member who was injured in the powerful truck bomb blast. Ambulance services say searchers also pulled 4 bodies from the rubble of the partially destroyed hotel. The hotel hosts the Chinese and Egyptian embassies in Somalia and is a popular spot for lawmakers and reporters. The National Union of Somali Journalists say 2 local journalists were among those killed while another was seriously wounded. U.S. President Barack Obama said Monday that the attack is a reminder that terrorist group like Al-Shabaab offer nothing but death and destruction and need to be stopped. The Chinese government's dramatic efforts to prop up the mainland's falling stock markets suffered a serious setback Monday as a major indexes suffered their biggest single-day plunge in 8 years. The Shanghai Composite Index lost 8.5%, while the CSI 300 Index of the largest listed companies in Shanghai and Shenzhen shed 8.6%. Main reason is that the Chinese stock markets are not done delivering, says Raymond Yong, senior economist of Greater China. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The deadly blast that struck a hotel in Somalia's capital just as Mr. Obama landed in Ethiopia Sunday was a reminder, the U.S. president said, of the very real threat facing the region.
That's VOA White House correspondent Aru Pandey reporting from Addis Ababa. Details next.
Also in the news, President Obama has announced that Kenya will be getting new support to prevent and treat HIV/AIDS among adolescent girls. And a female suicide bomber has killed at least 14 people at a market in northeastern Nigeria.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ethiopia, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, while hailing Ethiopia's role in fighting terrorism in East Africa, U.S. President Barack Obama has also urged the country's leaders to protect human rights and ensure good governance. VOA White House correspondent Aru Pandey has more on the president's talks with the Ethiopian prime minister in Addis Ababa.
The deadly blast that struck a hotel in Somalia's capital just as Mr. Obama landed in Ethiopia Sunday was a reminder, the U.S. president said, of the very real threat facing the region.
Yesterday's bombing in Mogadishu reminds us that terrorist groups like Al-Shabaab offer nothing but death and destruction and have to be stopped. We've got more work to do.
It was against this security backdrop that talks between President Obama and Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn took place Monday in Ethiopia's ornate National Palace. Mr. Obama, the first sitting U.S. president to visit Ethiopia, pledged U.S. assistance in the country's fight against extremists. He praised Ethiopian forces for helping to shrink the territory Al-Shabaab controls in Somalia and helping stabilize other countries as well.
They have one of the most effective militaries on the continent. And as I noted in my earlier remarks, they are also one of the biggest contributors to peacekeeping. And so they're averting a lot of bloodshed and a lot of conflict because of the effectiveness of their military. And we want to make sure that we're supporting them.
But along with praise for Ethiopia's military might came frank discussions on the country's human rights record. Prime Minister Haile Mariam's party took 100% of seats in May parliamentary elections and is accused of rounding up dozens of opposition members and journalists in so-called counterterrorism operations. In his opening remarks, the Ethiopian leader pledged to improve governance, noting, quote, "Our commitment to democracy is real, not skin deep."
We fully understand that the perception and the reality does not, in many cases, match as far as Ethiopia is concerned. Therefore, we want to work on this issue, but something has to be understood, that this is a fledgling democracy.
Calling Mr. Haile Mariam's government democratically elected, President Obama acknowledged what he called Ethiopia's difficult history and said, as in Kenya, there was still more work to do in terms of adhering to certain democratic principles.
Making sure to open additional space for journalists, for media, for opposition voices will strengthen rather than inhibit the agenda that the Prime Minister and the ruling party has put forward.
An area where both leaders saw eye to eye is trying to find a resolution to the deepening crisis in South Sudan. Following Monday's bilateral talks in the palace, President Obama convened a meeting with the leaders of Kenya, Uganda, Ethiopia, and the African Union in hopes of finding a path to peace. The U.S. leader warned time was running out as the humanitarian situation in South Sudan gets worse by the day. Aru Pandey, VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Kenya will be getting new support to prevent and treat HIV/AIDS among adolescent girls. President Obama announced yesterday that Kenya would be included in the DREAMS project. It's funded by the U.S., the Nike Foundation, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
Adolescent girls are hard hit by HIV/AIDS. It's estimated 7,000 die every year from the disease. They also account for about 74% of new infections among adolescents. The $210 million DREAMS project falls under PEPFAR, the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief. Dr. Deborah Birx is the U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator and in charge of PEPFAR.
DREAMS is a very exciting new program for us, where the D stands for determined, the R for resilient, the E for empowered, the A for AIDS-free, and the M for mentored, and the S for safe. And that acronym, that combination of items, we think is really going to be key to keep young women HIV-free.
Ambassador Birx says the overall rate of new HIV infections in sub-Saharan Africa has fallen over the last 10 years. She credits efforts by individual countries, PEPFAR, and the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and malaria. But she says changing demographics on the continent are having an effect on the epidemic.
Africa also has this exciting, expanding young adults. So there's 30% more young adults now than at the beginning of the HIV/AIDS epidemic. So you can see just by the sheer numbers, even if you hold the rates of HIV new infections at the same, because there's so many more young adults at risk, your actual number of HIV infected goes significantly up.
And adolescent girls and young women are bearing the brunt of that.
We know young women in general are 2 to 3 to 4, in some cases 10 times more likely to become HIV infected than young men of the exact same age group. So this is very much focused on meeting the needs of young women where they are in the communities to address their specific issues that lead to higher HIV risk, to ensure that they grow up as part of this commitment to an AIDS-free generation.
Kenya will receive $30 million extra in HIV funding from the DREAMS project. Programs are already in place, so they can begin right away. Dr. Birx attended the recent International AIDS Society Conference on Pathogenesis, Prevention, and Treatment in Vancouver, Canada. She says among the scientific studies presented was further proof that the sooner HIV-infected people receive antiretrovirals, the better.
If patients start on treatment early, they can have the almost identical lifespan to someone who is HIV negative. So this is extraordinarily exciting, and that's what's happened over the last decade in sub-Saharan Africa. So we've reversed the dying. Now we have to even do a better job on decreasing the number of new infections.
The PEPFAR chief says preventing new infections among adolescents is cheaper than treating them once they are infected. That, she says, could strain financial resources. Two of the biggest obstacles to helping girls and young women living with HIV are stigma and discrimination.
We feel like overall across the world we've made the least progress in stigma and discrimination. And this has really undermined the abilities of individuals and communities to protect themselves from HIV, because people are hiding their serostatus. There's still unrelenting stigma at the community level. So people living with HIV/AIDS around the world are still forced into the shadows of their communities.
She says as a result, fewer people are coming forward to be tested. People are hiding their antiretroviral pills, so friends and family won't learn their HIV status. Birx says it's critical women are empowered and have the means to protect themselves.
We know from our gender-based violence studies, we've been supporting what we call violence against children surveys in 10 African countries over the last 5 years, and it's clear that young women are specifically susceptible to gender-based violence and have a much higher risk of either acquiring HIV through gender-based violence or through other behaviors that occurred due to the gender-based violence that had occurred earlier.
Ambassador Birx says young women must stand up for themselves, but she also says communities have to wrap their arms around young women and value them and protect them from the perpetrators of gender-based violence. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Yeah. 15 minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Well, Reuters news agency quotes an unnamed U.S. official who says the Obama administration will discuss a so-called Plan B for South Sudan with African leaders. President Obama is meeting today in Addis Ababa with the presidents of Uganda and Kenya, the prime minister of Ethiopia, the chairwoman of the African Union, and foreign ministers of Sudan. The country has been engaged in civil war since December 2013. A regional group, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD, has been mediating peace talks between supporters of South Sudan's President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar. IGAD has set an August 17th deadline for both sides to accept a final offer. According to Reuters, the U.S. official said if the leaders do not reach a peaceful agreement, Plan B could include an arms embargo against South Sudan. Sanctions could also be imposed on the assets and travel of South Sudanese leaders. Regional countries, the UN, and the EU could also take part in the sanctions. The French press agency says the latest agreement would include rules for managing the economy and security. It would also outline power sharing between the two rival leaders.
Among the casualties of fighting in South Sudan are aid workers. Nearly 30 have been killed in recent months. Stephen O'Brien, UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, says he is shocked by the killings. As Charlton Doki reports from Juba, O'Brien joins a long list of officials calling on the two warring parties to sign a peace agreement and end the violence.
The fighting must stop and the atrocities must end immediately. Parties to the conflict need to urgently forge a sustainable political deal and deliver on their promises of peace to their people.
UN Emergency Relief Coordinator Stephen O'Brien was speaking to reporters over the weekend as he wrapped up a four-day visit to South Sudan, his first since assuming his new post 2 months ago. O'Brien said he was deeply shocked and saddened that aid workers are being harassed, targeted and killed.
27 of our colleagues have lost their lives and many more are missing and unaccounted for. This must stop. It is unacceptable. I call on all parties to uphold their obligations to comply with the principles of international humanitarian law, real law, and ensure the safe passage of humanitarian assistance. We need rapid and unhindered access to provide assistance to conflict-affected communities by the most efficient means possible, be that air, road, or river.
O'Brien says government officials have assured him that they will support thorough investigations into the killings and disappearance of humanitarian workers. During the visit, O'Brien visited a UN camp in Juba, hosting thousands of people displaced from their homes after fighting broke out in the capital nearly 20 months ago. O'Brien also visited an internally displaced people's camp in Nyal in Unity State's Panyijar County. While there, he says he met families who shared with him harrowing testimonies of what they have suffered. He says people who have lost loved ones told him, above all, what they want is peace.
They are tired of living in fear. They want to rebuild their lives. They've lost husbands, wives, children. Their homes and livelihoods have been destroyed. Their children are not in school, and thousands have been taken by armed elements. Women and girls have been targeted throughout the conflict. They have been beaten, abducted, raped, and set on fire.
O'Brien noted that civilians, especially women and children, bear the brunt of what he describes as a senseless war. He says the unchecked atrocities taking place across the country contradict the spirit of unity that led to South Sudan's independence, which many people, including in the international community, worked hard to achieve. O'Brien says South Sudan's leaders must take responsibility for their own actions and those who act in their name.
I call on the leadership of the warring parties to listen to the people and to lay down their arms, stop the violence, reconcile their differences, and commit to sustainable peace. If the violence continues, the already vast number of people suffering will continue to rise appallingly.
During his visit, O'Brien also met with top government officials, including President Salva Kiir, to urge them to end the suffering.
I shared with him our collective great sadness and disappointment that the hopes and dreams of the people of South Sudan at its birth 4 years ago, which I witnessed, are shattered.
O'Brien says he also urged President Kiir to ensure the current restrictions on barges transporting vital life-saving supplies on the River Nile be lifted immediately. The South Sudan Army says the decision to stop barges on the Nile was based on security reasons. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
Saudi-led coalition airstrikes in Yemen are on hold today at the start of a five-day humanitarian truce, although intense ground fighting continues in some areas after Houthi rebels rejected the ceasefire. Rebel attacks were reported today in parts of the south of the country. The coalition that has been fighting the Iranian-allied Houthi Shiite rebels with air attacks for the past 4 months declared the temporary truce to allow badly needed emergency supplies into Yemen. Yesterday, Houthi rebel Abdel Malak al-Houthi said a ceasefire would only benefit Islamic State and al-Qaeda militants. The battle goes on and the war is not over, al-Houthi was quoted as saying on his group's Twitter account.
In Nigeria news today, an explosion set off by a female suicide bomber has killed at least 14 people at a market in northeastern Nigeria. Witnesses say around 50 people were wounded. Officials say the early Sunday blast occurred at the entrance of the market in the town of Damaturu, the capital of Yobe State. No one has claimed responsibility for the attack. Earlier this month, at least 9 people were killed in Damaturu when a female suicide bomber targeted residents preparing for a Muslim festival to mark the end of Ramadan. Also in Nigeria, Reuters Wire Service says the government plans to break up the state-owned National Petroleum Corporation, or NNPC. President Muhammadu Buhari has said he supports reforms to the corporation, which is accused of corruption and mismanagement. An investigation in 2013 by former Central Bank Governor Lamido Sanusi revealed the corporation had failed to pay $20 billion to the government in the preceding year. Last month, the president dissolved the NNPC board. The president's spokesman, Fami Adesina, says the NNPC will be split into two entities, an independent regulator and an investor vehicle. The presidential spokesman did not say when the restructuring would take place.
Also, 1,000 entrepreneurs from around the continent were chosen to take part in a unique opportunity to learn from the best. They took part in the first boot camp for entrepreneurs sponsored by the Tony Elomelu Entrepreneurship Program, also known as TEEP, in Ota, Nigeria. Parmen Burvier is the CEO of the Tony Elomelu Foundation. She spoke with me about how the entrepreneurs were chosen for the boot camp, as well as what they accomplished.
The boot camp is part of a program called the Tony Elomelu Entrepreneurship Program. The program is the flagship program of the Tony Elomelu Foundation. It's a 10-year program to support and grow 10,000 Pan-African entrepreneurs over the next decade. And the program has a commitment of $100 million from our founder and chairman, Mr. Tony Elomelu, who is also the founder and chairman of the foundation. He has made a $100 million commitment to support and develop 10,000 Pan-African entrepreneurs over the next decade.
You all just recently had your very first boot camp, where you selected 1,000 entrepreneurs over 20,000 applicants. So how do you go about choosing?
So the program was announced on the 1st of December with that commitment of $100 million by an African philanthropist, investor, and a businessman, and Mr. Elomelu. On the 1st of January, we opened the portals for applications from across Africa, Pan-Africa, Portuguese-speaking Africa, Francophone Africa, and Anglophone Africa. We received over 20,000 applications from 52 African countries. The application process closed on the 1st of March, and over through March, We then engaged Accenture Development Partners to basically help us select the applications based against a criteria. So from 20,000, we selected 1,000 applicants across industry sectors from agriculture, ICT, education and training, fashion, media and entertainment, waste management, physical businesses, as well as technology-enabled businesses. So we went through a very rigorous process of selecting the 1,000, and we announced the selected Tony Alumilu entrepreneurs on the 23rd of January. After from that, the 1,000 then embarked on what we call the Seven Pillars of TEEP program. The first was a 12-week online business skills training program where they took their ideas and developed them over the next 12 weeks into a viable business plan. We also provided them with online mentors. We have over 400 mentors from around the world who signed up to join the program. The bootcamp was the continuation of that 12-week online training, a face-to-face, interactive, immersive experience where we flew the 1,000 from the 51 countries to Lagos for a three-day bootcamp.
Can you give an example of just what some of the sessions were like?
I mean, they were incredible sessions. There was a session around motivational, really, as you know, being an entrepreneur, it's a really a lonely, you know, lonely place to be. And how do you keep yourself inspired and how do you keep yourself motivated and focused on your mission and vision? We had a session on accessing finance, a critical issue for entrepreneurs anywhere in the world, but particularly so across Pan-Africa. We also had speed dating and really enabling and facilitating our entrepreneurs to build networks. That's what they had come here for the first time. You know, entrepreneurs from Rwanda got to meet entrepreneurs from Ghana, got to meet entrepreneurs from Nigeria. I think above all, I recognize that they were not the only ones having some of the challenges that they had in their own respective businesses or in their own country.
What are they saying are their biggest challenges?
Well, the biggest challenges are actually, again, very similar to every other entrepreneur. Obviously, access to finance. In Africa, it's infrastructure, you know, in terms of the internet, in terms of government, you know, regulation, getting government to really create an enabling environment for entrepreneurs and the recognition and the value that entrepreneurs bring to economic growth and social impact as well. But I think the biggest thing for them was to be able to connect with each other face-to-face and build those relationships and build, you know, future and present trading opportunities with each other.
That was Parminder Veer, the CEO of the Tony Elumelu Foundation. She spoke with me from Lagos, Nigeria.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. This is James Bhatti, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America. Thank you.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. U.S. President Barack Obama urges Ethiopian leaders to protect human rights and ensure good governance. And an explosion set off by a female suicide bomber has killed at least 14 people at a market in northeastern Nigeria. Coming up, we'll have music from Ethiopia. And in our feature segment, Zimbabweans are concerned that their 91-year-old president, Robert Mugabe, is taking too many foreign trips. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand a big football draw tops your sports report.
Kim, the preliminary draw for the 2018 World Cup football tournament was held over the weekend in St. Petersburg, Russia. Our friend in Lagos, Shagun Dot on the spot Adeyemi, gives us some of the African highlights from the draw.
Good evening, Africa. The top 13-ranked African football nations got a boost when the draw for the 2018 World Cup qualifiers was made in Russia. Each of the countries gets a first-round bye before facing one of the weaker national teams on the continent in the second round in November. Victories in the home and away ties will secure places in the 20-nation third round, from which the five group winners qualify for the World Cup to be hosted by Russia. Algeria is Africa's top-ranked team. The other 12 in that order are Ivory Coast, Ghana, Tunisia, Senegal, Cameroon, Congo, Cape Verde, Egypt, Nigeria, Guinea, Democratic Republic of Congo, and Mali. In the first round of the African qualifiers in October 2015, the 26th lowest-ranked African sides in the FIFA rankings play each other in two legs. Meanwhile, South Africa was handed a tough task when the draw was made. Bafana Bafana, which has played in the Global Football Showcase three times, was paired with fellow Southern African team Angola. It is the only one of 20 second-round ties featuring two former qualifiers, as Angola participated in the 2006 tournament. Here now are some of the other highlights of the African draw. Cameroon will start campaigning for a record-extending eighth appearance by an African team with an away game against Somalia or Niger. Nigeria, the second most frequent African qualifier, looks set to tackle Swaziland, African Cup of Nations title holder Ivory Coast, and Ghana. The team it defeated on penalties in the final last February are chasing fourth consecutive World Cup appearances. The Ivorians begin with a visit to Liberia or Guinea-Bissau, while Ghana travels to the Comoros Islands or Lesotho. Highest-ranked African team Algeria, which took eventual 2014 world champion Germany to extra time in a last 16 clash in Brazil, plays Tanzania or Malawi. Egypt, winner of the Cup of Nations a record seven times, but repeated World Cup qualifying flop, was drawn against Chad or Sierra Leone. Debutant South Sudan faces Mauritania, and Mauritius plays Kenya in the first round. Zimbabwe is the only one of the 54 Confederation of African Football members who did not take part in the draw. Staying with the 2018 World Cup, despite FIFA scandals, beleaguered President Sepp Blatter says the organization remains committed to 2018 World Cup host nation, Russia. During a meeting Saturday with Russian President Vladimir Putin ahead of the qualifying draw, the FIFA president told Putin that, quote, "We say yes to Russia. We are providing our support," unquote. Thanks so much for listening. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
This is Larry Zamuje, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 80.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja, Nigeria. Let's talk to you about Brilla FM. It's Nigeria's only sports station. Of course, we partner the VOA. VOA! And so you can listen to Sunny Side of Sports on 80.9 Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja. Keep listening, Africa, and enjoy Sunny Side of Sports on Brilla.
Thanks, Dr. Larry. In addition to Sports Radio, 88.9 Brilla FM stations in Lagos and Abuja, Dr. Larry also has stations in Kaduna and Onitsha, Nigeria. We're delighted to be your partner, Dr. Larry, so keep it sporty.
The Voice of America, VOA.
More football news now on the VOA. Mexico beat Jamaica 3-1 in the eastern U.S. city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to win its record-extending 7th CONCACAF Gold Cup trophy. Andres Guardado, Jesus Corona, and Oribe Peralta had the goals for the Mexicans, while Darren Maddox scored a consolation goal for the Reggae Boys of Jamaica in the 80th minute for the final margin. Despite the loss, the Jamaicans made a rousing run to the final, upsetting the United States 2-1 in the semifinals to become the first Caribbean team to reach the Gold Cup championship match. A pro-Mexico crowd of almost 69,000 attended the final at Lincoln Financial Field in Philadelphia. In the third-place match, Panama beat the USA on penalty kicks 3-2. Mexico will now play the United States, the 2013 Gold Cup champion, on October 9th for CONCACAF spot in the 2017 Confederations Cup tournament in Russia. The tournament is a warm-up for the World Cup in 2018. The VOA's Daybreak Africa sportsman Marco Uma joins us now with more sports news. And Mark's opening serve is African men's volleyball.
Tunisia beat Morocco by 3-1 as Cameroon dismissed Rwanda 3-0 at the Africa Men's Volleyball Championships in Cairo, Egypt on Sunday. On Saturday, Tunisia dismissed Rwanda 3-0 and Morocco beat Mauritius 3-0. Kenya outclassed Botswana 3-0 as Egypt edged Algeria 3-2. On Friday, Morocco beat Cameroon 3-1 as Tunisia outplayed Mauritius 3-0. In athletics, Kenya's former world junior champion Conseslus Kipruto won 3,000 meter steeplechase at the IAAF Diamond League in London, Britain on Saturday. Botswana's Nigel Amos and South Africa's Wade Van Niekerk triumphed in 800 meters and 400 meters respectively. Kenyans Asbel Kiprop, Eunice Sum and Mercy Cherono prevailed in men's 1 mile, women's 800 meters and 5,000 meters respectively. South Africa's Zach Fisser and Louis Fancel were runners up in men's long jump and 400-meter hurdles, respectively, as Nigeria's Blessing Okagbare Igotegwonor was second in women's 100 meters. Early on Friday, Somalia-born Mohamed Farah of Britain won 3,000 meters in a lifetime best and world-leading time of 7 minutes and 34.66 seconds. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa.
This is Africa. Zamina, mina, waka, waka, Zamina, mina, sangalewa. This time for Africa.
I'm very, 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 very excited. Ni chabulile. Hola.
Cause this is Africa. Zamina, mina, waka, waka, Zamina, mina, sangalewa. This time for Africa.
The Sunny Side of Sports welcomes your comments. You can send me email at sunny@voanews.com. Sunny is spelled S-O-N-N-Y. And pick up a pen or a pencil and a piece of paper. My full postal mailing address is The Sunny Side of Sports, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, room 1613, Washington, D.C., 20237. In cycling, British rider Chris Froome has won his second Tour de France title. VOA's Jonah Haskell has more details for us. Hi, Jonah.
Hey, Sonny. The 102nd Tour de France came to an end on Sunday in Paris as 2013 winner Chris Froome reclaimed his title, becoming the first Briton to win the Tour twice. Colombian rider Nairo Quintana had used the last couple of stages to cut Froome's lead down to about 3 minutes, or from about 3 minutes to just over one, but Froome was able to ward off the attack in the final stage to claim the win. Chris, who was born in Nairobi, Kenya, also became the first person to win the climbers competition and the overall race in the same year since Eddie Merckx did it in 1970. Spanish squad Movistar won the team classification, with Froome's Team Sky coming in second, while South Africa's MTN Kubeka was the fifth-ranked team, 1 hour and 14 minutes behind the leaders. The final stage on Sunday started in the Paris suburb of Sèvres before finishing on the famed Champs-Élysées in the heart of the French capital. German André Greipel won the final sprint to earn his fourth stage win, but did not finish in the top 15 overall. The race, which started on July 4th in Utrecht, Netherlands, and passed through parts of Belgium, Normandy, Brittany, the Pyrenees, and the Alps, covered a total of 3,360 kilometers and took Froome a cumulative 84 hours and 46 minutes to complete. The 2006 Tour de France will begin July 2nd of next year in the town of Mont-Saint-Michel, but before then, there are two more Grand Tour events to follow, as the Vuelta de España will be taking place in September, while the Giro d'Italia will begin in May 2016. With your Monday Tour de France update, I'm VOA's Jonah Haskell. Back to you, Sonny.
Thanks, Jonah. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. Once again, that address, facebook.com/VOA Sunny. And my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. If you go to my Facebook page, you'll see a video of Demetrius Cutchin. Demetrius is representing the city of Washington, D.C. at the Special Olympics World Games. And speaking of those games for intellectually disabled athletes, they officially opened over the weekend in Los Angeles, California. About 6,500 athletes from 165 countries marched into the Los Angeles Coliseum for the opening ceremonies. U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama welcomed the athletes and said they inspire hope and unity. During the 9-day competition, the athletes will compete in 25 different sports. The Special Olympics World Games are the biggest international sporting event to be held in Los Angeles since the 1984 Olympics. And getting back to my Facebook page, if you take a look at my current profile picture, you'll see a photo of me with Brightfield Shaddy. Bright is a Special Olympics ambassador, and he's in Los Angeles this week promoting the Special Olympics movement for intellectually disabled athletes. Shine the light, Brightfield Shaddy. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and thank you, Jonah. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, Zimbabweans concerned that their 91-year-old President Robert Mugabe is taking too many foreign trips. And next, increasing numbers of Nigerian refugees in Cameroon moving away from the volatile border area to a safer United Nations camp. But first, some music. Here is Teddy Afro of Ethiopia with Salimi. We'll be right back. Teddy Afro of Ethiopia with Salome.
Well, Zimbabweans are concerned that their 91-year-old President Robert Mugabe, who is also current chairman of the African Union, is taking too many foreign trips. They would like for him to stay at home to address the country's faltering economy. Mr. Mugabe is set to embark on several more foreign trips to attend to African Union business. Thomas Tirapasi has more from Harare.
Since assuming the rotational chairmanship of both the African Union and the Southern African Development Community, President Mugabe has hardly spent a week in Zimbabwe, as he has been traveling to several countries in Africa and beyond to attend to business involving the two continental organizations. But many Zimbabweans, such as Kudzai Gombeza, say Mr. Mugabe should not only address issues affecting Africa, but also focus on problems bedeviling his own country. Gombeza says the president's trips are draining the national fiscus.
I feel it's very unfair for the president to be traveling so much, especially in the case that our economy is not looking so good. You see, when he goes out of the country, he has a large entourage, he's got a lot of people that he travels with. And as far as I know, they say each time he goes out, he's given some money for security reasons, I think, which is unfair because that money can be used for the economy to get better than just traveling.
It is unclear how much Mr. Mugabe spends per trip in travel expenses, personal allowances, and related costs for his entourage, always numbering more than 70, including some top state officials, bodyguards, and family members. Indications are that some of the trips are funded by AU and SADC. Luke Tamborinyoka, spokesman of former Prime Minister and Movement for Democratic Change founding President Morgan Tsvangirai, says the president should prioritize issues affecting Zimbabwe than the entire continent.
It's definitely getting too much. The president is not taking seriously his national responsibility. Considering the magnitude of the national crisis, he ought to sit down and consider coming up with proper solutions to the monumental crisis facing the nation.
But political analyst Goodson Nguni, who has links with ZANU-PF, says the president does not use local resources when he is traveling on AU and SADC business. However, Mukono insists that Mr. Mugabe should delegate his deputies at the AU and SADC to take care of most issues in order to allow himself to attend to critical matters back home. Reporting from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
The UN Refugee Agency says increasing numbers of Nigerian refugees in Cameroon are moving away from the volatile border area to a United Nations camp in a more secure region inland. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
Nigeria's presidential election in March has done nothing to stop Boko Haram's destructive behavior. People continue to flee from violence in the country's northeast. Refugees who previously have fled to Cameroon to escape the violence in Nigeria are feeling increasingly threatened by cross-border attacks from the militant group. The UN Refugee Agency says Nigerian refugees who are camped along the border in Cameroon's remote far north region are seeking shelter at a refugee camp some 100 kilometers away. It says about 100 people each day are arriving and being registered at Minowao Camp, which is run by the UNHCR and partners. Agency spokesman Leo Dobbs says the camp population has risen from about 30,000 late last year to around 44,000 today. He says most of the new camp arrivals had earlier fled from Borno State to a escape militant Boko Haram attacks. He says until now, the refugees have stayed close to the border, hoping they could return home quickly.
Now, we and the government have been encouraging people to move further south to safer areas, where to Minawa, where they can be helped and where they're safer. The volatility of the border was borne out earlier this month when there was been a series of attacks and clashes, including a suicide bombing on July the 12th, the first such attack in Cameroon. It took place in the northern town of Futukol.
The UNHCR has limited access in the far north region because of security concerns. Nevertheless, it estimates some 12,000 unregistered refugees are living along the border. The Cameroonian authorities believe that number may be as high as 17,000. Dobbs says the government has begun registering Nigerian refugees in the area. He tells VOA the registration process is provoking fear among some refugees that they might be returned to Nigeria against their will.
There's always fear that of people being forced back. And we have in the past urged the authorities in Niger and Cameroon to keep the doors open to refugees and to not to send people back against their will.
In a separate development, the UNHCR says some 2,500 Nigerian refugees reportedly have arrived in the Difa region of southern Niger in the past few days. This follows an attack by Boko Haram militants on the Nigerian town of Damasak early last week. It says most of the new arrivals are women, children, and the elderly. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Jackson Mvunganyi, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
According to human rights organizations and Chinese activists, in recent weeks, Chinese authorities have systematically detained, arrested, subjected to forced disappearance, held incommunicado, or questioned and released 169 lawyers, legal staff, and activists involved in peacefully challenging official policies in China. Chinese authorities detained lawyers from several law firms, including six from the Beijing Feng Rei firm. The Feng Rei law firm handled a number of high-profile human rights cases, including the case of jailed Uyghur scholar Ilham Tohati. The crackdown began on July 9th when Feng Rei lawyer Wang Yu disappeared after alerting friends via a text message that her internet connection and electricity had been cut off and that people were trying to break into her home. Wang had represented several clients involved in human rights activism or religious freedom issues, including practitioners of Falun Gong, a religious group banned in China. The firm's director, Zhu Shifeng, was also detained. He had represented Zhang Miao, a Chinese journalist who'd reported on the Hong Kong democracy protests. Among those who have not been heard from since being detained is well-known lawyer Lu Heping. He represented fellow lawyer and blind activist Chen Guangcheng and helped victims of forced evictions. The United States is deeply concerned that the broad scope of China's new national security law is being used as a legal facade to commit human rights abuses. The U.S. strongly urges China to respect the rights of all its citizens and to release all those who have recently been detained for seeking to protect the rights of Chinese citizens.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.